This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this year-end edition of the program, we bring you highlights from 2019. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. In February, the Hong Kong government proposed an amendment that, for the first time, would allow suspects in Hong Kong to be extradited to mainland China. Critics expressed fear that the bill would weaken Hong Kong's judicial system and undermine the one country, two systems model, which gave the former British colony a considerable degree of autonomy. The 50-year pact was signed in 1997 when authority over Hong Kong was transferred from Britain to mainland China. The proposed extradition bill set off a powerful wave of protests that continue to this day. The first large-scale demonstration took place in March. Then, on Sunday, June 16, approximately 2 million people out of a population of only 7.4 million thronged the streets of Hong Kong. Even though Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam eventually withdrew the controversial extradition bill, demonstrators said her action was too little too late, and several new demands had arisen since the protests began, including an independent investigation into violence by Hong Kong security forces against civilians. Well, joining me for an update on the status and implications of the Hong Kong protests were Ashley Feng, research associate at the Center for a New American Security, and Matt Schrader, a China analyst at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. They shared their thoughts on the protest movement and discussed how Beijing has been chipping away at the freedoms outlined in the One Country, Two Systems Agreement.
So I think the extradition bill was just a culmination of what you've seen over the past few years coming out of Beijing. And at this point in time, it's not just the extradition bill. The extradition bill symbolized this larger movement towards Beijing suppressing Hong Kong's basic freedoms that are supposed to be allowed until 2047. And so it's understandable why the protesters have additional demands to ensure that they can still have these freedoms until 2047. I think what you're seeing, though, is this disagreement between whether or not these basic freedoms should be ensured during this period of time, especially as Beijing is trying to increase its presence on the world stage. Hong Kong, as an autonomous region that's part of China, if Beijing cannot quell what it sees as its own protests at home, what does that mean for its global leadership abroad as well?
Thanks for emphasizing and clarifying what's at stake. Turning to you now, Matt Schrader, for your take on where the protests stand thus far. And of course, we have to remind our listeners that Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam is pretty much a puppet, one could say, of the Beijing government. And one of the demands of the protesters is that they are able to vote for their leaders directly. So your take on where things stand at this point?
One thing that I think is getting lost a little bit in a lot of the conversation around the protests, even in Western analysis, even in quite friendly pro-democracy Western analysis, is some of the political history over the past 20 or 30 years between Hong Kong and China, because we kind of check back in on this situation once every 5 years or so when something big flares up. There's been a long history, actually, of broken promises on Beijing's side to move the territory towards actual greater autonomy and self-government. There were a couple of occasions quite soon after the handover in 1997 when Beijing actually promised that full suffrage would be implemented for the territory, that they'd be able to vote directly for the chief executive, which currently is appointed by a body that's more or less named by Beijing. And there were actually deadlines set for the date that full suffrage would arrive. And those deadlines were pushed back by Beijing a couple of times. And that's one of the things that touched off the huge umbrella protest movement in 2014, was that Beijing offered the protesters a version of full suffrage, what they called full suffrage, that wasn't full suffrage. It was not going to be people directly voting for the chief executive. And that's why you had people taking to the streets in 2014. And obviously, that didn't have the result that they were looking for in 2014. And not only that, but many of the leaders of those very, very peaceful protests, and I went there, I saw it myself, they were unbelievably peaceful and well organized. Many of the leaders of these peaceful democratic protests were eventually imprisoned, were in some cases forced out of their job or forced into early retirement. Beijing's controls over the city's media and over other levers of power were actually deepened and strengthened. Now we're at a point where there are some people who are saying protesters should have taken the deal in 2014, or they need to find a way to find a middle ground with Beijing at this point. And I don't think people who are putting that argument out are really taking into account this history of promises for democracy being made that weren't kept. And that's in the minds of all these protesters, that something was promised, they didn't get it, and is the other side a good faith interlocutor?
Turning to domestic politics, in July of 2019, former special counsel Robert Mueller testified before the House of Representatives Judiciary and Intelligence Committees 4 months after he released his long-awaited report on Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election and any links between President Donald Trump's campaign and Russia. Alan Lichtman, distinguished professor of history at American University, and Mark Simakovsky, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, joined me for a discussion about the significance of Mueller's testimony before these committees.
It was critical to hear from him directly because so few Americans, 3% or less, actually read the very damning Mueller report. And of course, Mueller was criticized for not being more forceful, for even being stumbling at times. But in my view, that simply added to his credibility. This was clearly not someone out to get the president. After all, he's a lifelong Republican. This was not run by a Democrat. And I think Mueller bent over backwards to be fair to President Trump and not to engage in this so-called witch hunt. And as your quotations indicated, Mueller found 10 instances of obstruction of justice. And, you know, if you listen to the apologists for Donald Trump, they say, well, he can do really what he wants in his authority as commander-in-chief. I think that's wrong. You can't do it for a corrupt purpose. But leave that aside. There are plenty of things he did that had nothing to do with that, like asking his White House counsel Don McGahn to lie, to create a false record about him directing McGahn to fire Mueller, or creating a false record of the notorious meeting between Russian operatives and Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort at Trump Tower. In addition, as you've indicated, he did not clear the president of collusion. And he did find, not only did the president welcome Russian help and have his team have more than 100 contacts with the Russians, Mueller said something very important that was missed in his testimony, that in using the stolen emails that were obtained through criminal activity by the Russians, the president was actually bolstering illegal activity. If this isn't enough to start an impeachment investigation, I don't know what possibly could be.
Let me turn to Mark Simakovsky for your take on the importance of Mueller's long-awaited testimony and what you heard.
Aside from the political circus that enveloped this testimony, both sides, I think, were a bit disappointed by Mueller's testimony, except for the president. But I think what's important, and maybe what was missing from Mueller's emphasis and focus, because many of the questions were about the president, was about Russia's role. And what was Russia's role? And it was a role that was clearly defined and directed from the Kremlin to attack and undermine the United States democracy and U.S. interests. And this report, at 400 pages, had very specific evidence to back up that accusation, also very specific indictments against Russian officials and Russian intelligence service agents that directed and carried out these indictments. And of course, additionally, U.S. citizens that were involved in this essentially conspiracy to engage in a way that would take information from the Russian Federation and improve Donald Trump's chances for becoming the president of the United States. And Mr. Mueller, I think, opened and closed his remarks highlighting the threat that Russia places. But of course, the wider concern is because anything that has to do with Russia is labeled by the president and his allies as a hoax, as a political circus, that actually is incorrect because there is clear evidence and clear focus and an investigation that has highlighted Russia's role. And Russia's continuous nefarious activity is happening today at home. Russia will meddle in the next election here in 2020. And Russia's actions abroad, I think, continue to showcase and should showcase the American people that we need to take this threat seriously.
You're listening to the Best of Encounter 2019 on The Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that Encounter is available for free download from our website at voanews.com/encounter and from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. On this year-end edition of the program, we send a big thank you and a shout-out to Antoine Kamuenyi. He's a loyal listener from the Democratic Republic of Congo. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, now let's get back to highlights from the Best of Encounter 2019. In October, President Trump announced his decision to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria's border with Turkey, leaving U.S.-allied Kurdish forces to the mercy of the Turkish government, which considers them a terrorist group. Henri Barki, senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Aykan Erdemir, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, joined me for a discussion about the dire strategic implications of the U.S. troop withdrawal from Syria, which paved the way for a Turkish incursion and an assault on allied Kurdish forces.
It's hard to find the beginning to this question in the sense that this is probably one of the biggest self-inflicted policy nightmares that the United States has ever engaged in the sense that there was a system in northeast Syria that was designed to stop ISIS. ISIS was not completely defeated because ISIS could go underground. There are also thousands of ISIS prisoners that the Kurds hold whose fate remains unknown. And so essentially what President Trump did was to give northern Syria to the Russians, to the Syrians, and to the Turks, and essentially also create the conditions under which ISIS can reemerge. And in the process, of course, the Turkish army has brought with it in tow large number of jihadist elements, locals who the Turks trained, but are, from the videos and everything else we've seen, behave more like Al-Qaeda or ISIS elements than a regular army. And they have inflicted amazing damage on the civilian population in northeastern Syria. We have probably 200,000 internally displaced people from northern Syria, and that number is going to increase as the Turks consolidate their position. Strategically speaking, we have allowed Russia to now assume greater control of Syria. Trump may not care about this, but the rest of the world cares about it.
Turning to you, Aykan Erdemir, for your take. Of course, the United States had so few troops there to begin with, and their very presence was really critical to this delicate balance of keeping IS at bay and protecting the Kurds who were allied with the United States. Why do you think President Trump did this? I mean, we know he tends to like dictators. He never says a bad word regarding Vladimir Putin. Some say maybe it's just politics of 2020. He wants to appeal to his base, and he has promised them that he's going to bring, you know, troops back and end so-called endless wars. I mean, what's the motivation here?
I think President Trump is an isolationist at heart, and he has always been planning to disengage from overseas deployments. And this was probably the worst place to start that withdrawal. Why? Because ultimately, this is a self-defeating move, even for Trump's own worldview. Trump, without realizing, was successfully building a new model of engagement in the Middle East. This was the leanest, the most cost-effective, and successful engagement the U.S. had in decades. It relied heavily on local partners, and only 1,000 to 2,000 U.S. special forces basically helped turn the tide of the war against the Islamic State, kept Russia and Iran out, and kept the Assad regime out. But more importantly, U.S. managed to help build inclusive institutions in the Middle East where ethnic and religious minorities are always at risk. U.S. helped build a model with the political wing SDC and with the military wing SDF. Syrian Arabs, Syrian Kurds, Syriac Christians, Yazidis, Turkmen, all of them came together, definitely with shortcomings. But at least if you compare them to what was there before under the Islamic State, this was a remarkable transformation of Northeast Syria. This was a remarkably lean model that not only provided security, but also a slow, gradual, but consistent path to building an inclusive and secular polity, a secular governance model in the Middle East. And I think President Trump has just robbed himself of what could have been his biggest victory. This could have been the Trump doctrine. This could have been the lean and effective way of engaging with the world. And now here he is, not only an isolationist, but I think also one of the biggest losers of the big power game in the Middle East.
In another Middle East development, waves of demonstrations, some violent, have racked Iraq and Lebanon since early October. There seems to be a common theme behind the protests in both countries, as people angry over corruption, poor governance, and the lack of jobs have taken to the streets. Les Campbell, Senior Associate and Regional Director for Middle East and North Africa Programs at the National Democratic Institute, and Ellen Lapson, Professor and Director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, joined me to compare and contrast the protests in Lebanon and Iraq and examined the key role Iran plays in both countries.
The protests in Iraq and Lebanon are driven from the same impulse that drives smaller versions of unrest in Morocco, where teachers have been striking, Algeria, where people have been on the streets every Friday, I think almost since January, even in places like Jordan, which are, you know, more stable and you normally don't see protests. You've had people marching, camping outside the royal court, asking for reform. They're also against certain types of tax increases. So the whole region has a surge of demand. People are just tired of the status quo. They want change. And they want a better future, they want more say in their future. But I think what sets Iraq and Lebanon apart, and I think why it's a bit more spectacular, is that there is a sectarian aspect to it. You know, both countries have political systems which are very much informed and structured according to the religious sect that people belong to. There's a sense that these political systems are very restrictive, that change is more difficult, you know, at least in, say, Morocco and Jordan, there's a certain responsiveness. But I think in Iraq and Lebanon, people feel that the system is sort of calcified and they're on the streets saying they're sick and tired of it. But like most political movements, I think at the heart of all this is economics. The pocketbooks are hurting. Lebanon, its inflation is rising. Banks don't have currency. There are controls on how much you can take out of the bank. It's hard to get any hard currency. In Iraq, you know, jobs are hard to find for young people. No one knows the exact unemployment rate, but among young people, it may be 40%. It may be higher. At its heart, it's economic. But to get to economic answers, people realize that their political system has to change.
Turning to you, Ellen, for your take on the common denominators of the protests, particularly in Iraq and Lebanon.
So, Carol, I like to put this in even maybe a larger frame, which is the Arab Spring. It began in 2011 with the fall of regimes in Tunisia and Egypt. It then mutated into very violent civil wars in Yemen and Syria. But the quick conclusion was that, oh, well, those valiant young people in the Arab world tried, but they failed, and it's over. Well, I never thought the Arab Spring was over. I thought that it was the beginning of a shift of mindset of whether people do think they have the voice to expect more of their governments. And so I really find it very powerful and compelling, even though it may not produce results in the short run. But I think it's quite a powerful human story to see people in these distinct countries saying, we're not satisfied. And I completely agree with Les that there's a fundamental base that's economic grievance. But I'm kind of fascinated by the political ideas that are circulating here. What I find particularly interesting about that is young Lebanese and Iraqis, and I shouldn't say they're all young, there's people of many ages participating in this, they want to go back to a national identity that isn't based on sect. And they resent that the political elites of their country have sort of frozen this sectarian identity as almost more important than national identity. And I think people really are looking for a cleaner, more open, more transparent political set of choices where they can choose on the merits of an individual political actor, not on their sectarian identity.
Finally, in early November, the U.S. House of Representatives voted along party lines to approve rules for a formal impeachment inquiry into President Donald J. Trump, as it headed from a closed-door process into a more public phase. At the heart of the inquiry was a July 25th phone call between U.S. President Donald Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. During that call, Mr. Trump allegedly sought to withhold almost $400 million in critical military assistance to Ukraine, which is under siege by Russia, until Ukraine's leader promised to conduct investigations into Trump's 2020 main political rival, former Vice President Joe Biden, as well as his son Hunter. Testimony after testimony by career public officials corroborated this alleged extortion. P.J. Crowley, former Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs, and Markson Makovsky, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, discussed the ramifications of the impeachment inquiry into U.S. President Donald Trump.
It is significant, and I think it is vitally important that the proceedings move from the evidence collection stage, if you will, to a public phase where the American people and others can begin to understand the context of what the House of Representatives is investigating. I served on the National Security Council staff during the impeachment of Bill Clinton. And I think, fortunately for Bill Clinton, it was a world without Twitter. And so despite his domestic political challenges at home, Clinton used foreign policy, the challenges in Bosnia, Kosovo, Iraq, pursuing peace in Northern Ireland and the Middle East. He was able to use foreign policy to convey to the American people that notwithstanding impeachment, I'm continuing to do my job. I think, unfortunately for President Trump, in this age of Twitter and cable news, you're beginning to see a White House that is obsessed with the impeachment inquiry. But this will all play out in front of the American people.
Well, Markson Makovsky, the White House may be obsessed with the impeachment inquiry, but some would argue that if the White House had not stonewalled on simple requests for documents and witnesses in the aftermath of the Robert Mueller probe into Russia's interference in the 2016 elections and not characterized this impeachment inquiry or the fact that the Congress has the absolute duty to conduct oversight, that perhaps we wouldn't be where we are today. The Congress is a co-equal branch of government, and one of their duties is to conduct oversight. So quickly, your take on the significance of this vote.
You know, this vote is clearly significant in that it brings the investigation into the public realm, which the Speaker has been pressured to do. Of course, the Speaker has been resistant into conducting impeachment hearings until this Ukraine crisis, in a way, fell into the House's lap. This was not something that was neither asked for nor generated by anyone other than the President of the United States. So in many ways, there was, I believe, a requirement to move forward. And as more witnesses have been called and as more information has come to light corroborating how this Ukraine investigation and the president's actions were detrimental to U.S. national security, and potentially people around the president have also lied about the role that the president has played and the rationale for the decision, I think has only fueled the need for continuing to conduct this investigation and conduct it in a way that will provide the American people the ability to have full transparency into the investigation. So I do think it's critical, but I also think that there's going to continue to be new areas of information that are going to surprise many people and potentially new witnesses that will likely continue to accelerate the reality that the House will most likely impeach the president this year.
And as we know, the House of Representatives did just that. On December 18, Donald J. Trump became the third president in U.S. history to be impeached. Nearly all of the Democrats, led by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, along with Republican-turned-independent Congressman Justin Amash, supported the abuse of power and obstruction of Congress charges against Mr. Trump. He faces a Senate trial early next year. And that's Encounter's look back at 2019. Thanks to Rick Pantaleo for producing this year-end edition of the program. Our engineer was John Ellison. I'm Carol Castiel. From all of us at the VOA Current Affairs Programming Desk, here's wishing you a very happy, healthy, and peaceful new year. And please join me again next week and next year for another Encounter on The Voice of America.